Okay, yes, we've pressed the record button, so it's happening.
We're running.
Everything yeah. is happening.
Oh my God, we're on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go.
Yeah, you go, Holly. All right, so this is your buddy. We're bringing him.
Oh, how do you know? How do you know? I booked this special guest because of his musical knowledge.
Now you're building my path. Now you're building my path.
Yeah, I am. I already have. So, hey, Dave.
Hey, Holly, what's going on?
Hey, welcome to What Difference Does It Make?
It's great to be here. I love when we bring in special guests.
We have a guest. I'm so excited. We've been waiting for you. I mean, not just today. We've been waiting for you to arrive in Los Angeles. I'm so excited to have you because you're an encyclopedia. But
who is this
I'm going
to
introduce you.
Yeah, please do.
This is Dan McGrath, currently the creative director at No Sheet Music, which is a music production house in the UK. He's also a composer and producer of music and TV themes, most notably, can I say it? I know.
Yeah.
Okay. Most notably for, I'll start with Dancing with the Stars because that's how we know it here, but also Strictly Come Dancing in the UK.
Yep.
And I'm going to let Dan, so those are some of his credentials. I'm going to let him tell you about his past because he's also a radio guy and a music guy. So give us a little. Dan, take it away.
We will.
Welcome. Yay.
Hello.
Thank you. All right. Woo.
You've done all the headlines now. I've got to kind of go through the dull stuff. You can tell me when it gets dull.
I have more if you want me to say it. It's much more exciting coming from you.
My career, I spent my time trying to be in music because that's what I love, I hope. And started when I was a sound engineer back in the 80s, as we all know and love. When I was very young, I went into a recording studio and saw mixing desks and I saw speakers. And I thought, I want to be in a room like this as much as I can be for the rest of my life. And hey, here we are again in a room with speakers and mixing desks. So that was kind of my remit. Bought Starman when I was 7 years old. And from then on in, I was tried to get into the world of music and recording studios. So my career was a sound engineer. I went through radio production in the 90s. So for 10 years, I worked with a guy called Chris Evans who... he was kind of billed as the UK Howard Stern at the time in the 90s. He was the enfant terrible, and we went on the air and we did Zoo format radio. So we did this a lot. We sat in a room together with mics and we just shot the breeze. It felt like, you know, it was a bit more than that. And that was a phenomenal time in my career because I just did some very high profile radio shows and met lots of very famous people and had a lot of wild times. That's a different podcast, that one, ladies and gentlemen.
That's going to be the added value.
Yeah, stop me when I'm rambling. So that was that. And then in 2001 there was a moment where we were famously sacked. The whole team was sacked, and it's recorded in the UK press quite publicly. And weirdly, I just bumped into somebody in LA and went, hey, and he went, hey, and I knew him around that time. So there's a thing. And he's now living in Beverly Hills and having a good time. I went into writing TV music in 2001 and I teamed up with a guy called Josh Phillips and we just started getting work writing entertainment music mainly. And so the Strictly / Dancing with the Stars thing was early on in about 2004, came to America in 2006, that piece of music. And so for us, that was kind of opened doors and got us to write a lot of TV music and entertainment TV music. So very short pieces of music that don't last long.
And you've won awards for them.
Well, we get an ASCAP award, which is, in the States, the ASCAP is one of the collection societies that collects royalties on music. So we get an award from ASCAP every year, not because the music's any good. We get an award because the music just gets played. But I'm not arguing.
An award is an award. I don't have any.
Hey, although as my friend Mitch says, don't thank me, pay me. But, so we get an award for that reason, because it gets broadcast. It's one of the most broadcast pieces of music in America, or was. Maybe we won't get one this year. I don't know. So we get to go and sit in a room with people who did CSI and those kind of shows. And it's cool. It's really cool.
And how did you get in the door? I mean, you miraculously, this music doesn't just end up on a producer's desk and it's like, oh, this is brilliant. That's it. Who is this? I don't know. You know,
David,
I don't care.
You know, it's who you know. It's absolutely who you know. And at the time when I went in to write TV music, it was because I had a really good black book full of people that were in television and radio. And I kind of thought this is a way of continuing a career. The executive producer phoned me up and said, we're looking for pitches. And so it's, and in the UK, it was a show that was, it was, so they said it's like Saturday night. The guy presenting it was a guy called Bruce Forsyth, the late Bruce Forsyth, who is a British TV icon. And they said it's a dancing show. And it's back in the 70s, there was a show called Come Dancing on in the UK. And my mum and I used to watch this show, and it was really dull. It was like, there's Jenny and Steve, and they're going to be doing the Paso Doble. And Steve's wearing the black outfit, and Jenny's wearing it off the shoulder. And it was all very low key and very British. And they said, yeah, we're going to do that show, but with celebrities. And it was around the time in the UK where everything was called All Star This or Celebrity That. Every TV show was, you know, any entertainment.
That's back, by the way.
That's back. Yeah, it's doing that already. Yeah. So they were going, but we're going to call it. It was going to be called Celebrity Come Dancing, and then they changed it to Strictly Come Dancing because of Strictly Ballroom. And I remember saying to Josh, the guy I write with at the time, "That's a terrible idea. Nobody's going to watch that show." It's still on in the UK, nearly 15, 16 years later, and it's not showing any signs of going anywhere.
That's crazy. And is that where Ray Davies probably got the title?
Well, Come Dancing. Yeah. Well, no, he was way before that. Oh, you see the TV show? Yeah, probably the original.
The title of his song in the '80s, Come Dancing.
It may well have been from that dance show. Yeah, it could have been.
Okay. Let's just say yes.
Who knew?
We're going to say yes.
Yes.
Ray did.
Yes.
Phone in Ray now.
Ask him. Ask him next time you speak with him.
All right.
So he's not listening.
So then let's go back. Should we go to the... how do you want to take this?
Okay. So we met through the radio business, music. Yep. But the reason I was so excited to have you on the show is because of your vast knowledge of 80s music. And I thought it would be really fun to talk with you, although I'll probably end up really being really embarrassed. Dave won't, because he knows everything, but he probably doesn't know everything about the type of music that Dan knows about.
I don't know it across the pond.
The interesting thing is going to be that, isn't it? The cultural differences, because there's a shedload of bands that you guys probably know and love or knew and love. And a load of bands that I know and love that were very UK-centric, and, you know, you got the US-centric bands. So that'll be interesting. I don't know if I have an encyclopedic knowledge, but I'm, you know...
Well, you're passionate.
Let's say 80s electronica. Let's go there, because I can hopefully give it a go. But if we start getting really nerdy about it, I might struggle. I have my classic 80s pop book here.
Certainly in general,
so I can get that out at any point.
Did you buy that just because you knew you were coming here?
Hey, no. This was on my shelf, because people know me. So somebody bought this for me, and I've got a quick list I'm going to have to throw at you in a minute for a certain reason, but anyway, go on.
Okay. Do you want to open with that?
Well, okay, I will do if you want me to. So, you know, the whole notion of this being an 80s-centric program, there was something I wanted to do, which was, I think, and you may have well have done this in one of your previous shows, but I think it was worth doing.
You haven't listened to all of them?
No, I've listened to a few, obviously. Is that
Thank you for listening.
What I've done is, there's one year that isn't in the 80s that I think needs to be an honorary member of the 80s, and that is 1979.
I agree with you.
For the sole reason that if I start reading this list of big hits from 1979, this is the UK, but a lot of these will transfer. If this isn't part of the 80s, there's something wrong, because this year spawned so many great bands, so many hits. And also for me, Gary Numan and Two-Way Army are in there, and... You know, that for me, it was once I loved Bowie too much, I was looking for other stuff. And when Gary Numan appeared on the scene, that was it for me. I was like, he's the next guy for me. So 79, and I'll only quickly skim through this because it will get boring, but you had like Our Friends Electric, Chibway Army, I Don't Like Mondays, Boomtown Rats, Blondie, Heart of Glass, Roxy Music, Dance Away, Injury, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, the YMCA, The Village People, 1979. I would have said it was earlier than that, but maybe, I don't know.
Me too.
Police Message in a Bottle, M Pop Music, Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall. So it goes on and on. Cars, Newman, obviously. So 79, Squeeze, obviously we love Squeeze. ELO are in there, Madness are in there, Flying Lizards, you know, it goes on and on and on. So I think 79, if you want to throw that in as an 80s year, it's a kind of, it's the runway year, isn't it?
I'm going to guess you graduated high school in, let's say, 1979?
No, you're saying high school, so you're saying, is that secondary school for me?
Sorry.
I would have been... I was born 66, so I would have left.
Okay, very good. All right. So my apologies to you. You're clearly younger than 5 years. I was off by 5 years.
So I was going mad once I hit about 13, 14 years old.
Oh, of course, like all of us.
Yeah, that was when it was.
And I think you were probably looking on the UK version of that, because some of those songs, like I do believe, like YMCA probably didn't hit
It was earlier.
After
no,
hit the US, and then it probably went to the UK.
It could well have been. Yeah, absolutely. But obviously, a lot of British acts there.
Oh yeah,
I don't know how quickly they got over here.
So, what was your So, what was your first album you bought? With your own money?
Hunky Dory, I think, was the first album I bought.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was taken down to HMV, which was now, I think even HMV exists anymore, but in Putney High Street in Southwest London, my mother took me down to HMV and I was 7 years old. And because I had great music taste in my house, my mum had very young music taste and my brother was listening to lots of kind of new wave and prog rock and all that kind of loads of stuff. But so I went with my, probably was 99p at the time, and bought Starman David Bowie 7-inch of vinyl over the counter, you know. And I listened to that repeatedly, and went to sleep singing the words in my head, slightly OCD. Yeah. So I think Hunky Dory was probably the first full album I bought. And yeah, I would say to this day, still probably in the top three albums for me ever, you know.
Wow. So
what was yours, Dave?
The first album I bought?
Yeah.
With your own money.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking it was, as I'm thinking back, it was probably the Cars in 78.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that was like one of them. And also the Knack and that 79 era. Honestly, I don't really know. I remember buying a lot of 45s.
Yeah.
I remember like Undercover Angel, I think was one of them, which I learned later was about masturbating, but who knew?
I don't think I ever knew that.
Oh, yeah.
So look thanks.
Read the lyrics again. You'll be shocked. It's shocking.
I don't know that song, you see. So who did that?
That was like Alan O'Day.
Okay.
Which
yeah.
And where is he now? Did he masturbate himself to death?
Probably.
You know that could happen.
Yeah. I heard that can happen. I hear you can grow
yet
hair
here you
on
are.
Your palms or something. Yeah.
Okay,
well, suddenly go blind.
Yes, exactly.
That's going on the playlist, so you will hear it if you listen to the Spotify playlist, because there's going to be one for all the songs that we talk about today.
Okay, I'm going to try and think of a really obscure song that might not be on Spotify. We'll talk about Taylor Swift or Adele or somebody who doesn't want this song.
Well, this seems like a good time to take a break, so we'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them? was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So welcome back to What Difference Does It Make? So did you immediately gravitate to keyboards, or what were you playing?
I'm a terrible musician.
Okay.
No, I
that's not true. I know it's not true. You're very modest.
The first thing I did with my mate John when we were about 16 or 17, we tried to buy synthesizers because we wanted to sound like Depeche Mode. We wanted to do that. So I bought a terrible little keyboard called a Casio VL1, which now is kind of slightly collectible. And then the first proper... did you ask me what synths I bought? Anyway, I'm going to tell you because I'm obsessed with synthesizers.
Go ahead.
My mate John bought a Roland SH-09, which is a classic mono synth, and everybody these days is now buying all this kind of remade, reworked versions of these things. And I bought what was called a Sequential Circuits Pro 1, and I've still got it. It's still in my studio. I just renovated it, just put a new keyboard into it, and it's the greatest mono synth ever. And I've had people come over, and you switch it on, and they play it, and they go, oh, my God, this is fantastic, if they're kind of, you know, analog synth freaks. And we were two fingers. You couldn't play chords.
Why is that? What is it about the sound?
How long have we got, Dave?
Because
this can get really nerdy. The Pro 1 has Vince Clark, the great Vince Clark, who spawned, you know, brilliant 80s bands left, right, and center, had the Pro 1 and did all the Yazoo first albums on it. So if you listen to Don't Go and those tracks off Upstairs at Eric's, loads of that was done on the Pro 1. And he loved it because the envelopes on it, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, this is kind of lose a few of you. The envelopes on it were really fast, really quick. The attack, you have an envelope, and a sound has an envelope, has an attack, a decay, a sustain, and release. These are the points of an envelope. The attack on the Pro 1 is really quick, so you can do bass drums with it. So you can get it to do this sound, but it'll do really, really tight bass sounds and stuff. So when you listen to those early Vince Clark songs, and he was obsessed with everything being metronomic and being on the 16th beat or whatever it was, because he was a computer musician first and foremost, the Pro 1 for him was like, that was the thing. So that was my synth, and I bought it in Soho Soundhouse, and I took it back I treated myself to a taxi back from London with this massive box and this synthesizer, and that, yeah, never looked back.
what is the quintessential Vince Clark song? I mean, like, for you, like, what is, like, when you think of that sound, and, you know, like, if I was going to put something on the Spotify playlist,
well, it's either Don't Go, I'm trying to think,
where you hear the bass and like it's,
yeah, and that, like, dum 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 dum, yeah, dum dum dum, yeah, dum, yeah, dum, yeah. That's the Don't, that's the Pro 1. And then he did Only You is all Pro 1. Only You is all Pro 1 from start to finish. All the bass drums and that do 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 that, all that, it's delayed. That's all Pro 1, that whole track. So if you put Only You on, that's the Sequential Circuits Pro 1, ladies and gentlemen.
I put it on often. It's one of my favorite songs of all time.
It's a fantastic song. And of course, it was that brilliant blending of electronics and soul, which lots and lots of duos did in the 80s.
That voice. So you're listening to the synth. I'm listening to the voice.
Well, that was it. Alison Moyer with her bluesy, soulful voice, and then Vince with his totally clinical, electronic, you know, staccato sounds.
It's like he's writing for some of these when we do our research.
Yeah, for sure. And then, okay, so let's go to your first show you saw. What was that?
Funnily enough, I was never a massive gig goer, but the first one,
because you were locked in your room with your computers and just
I don't know. I was Gary Numan, 1979 Living Ornaments tour at Hammersmith Odeon, And so he was still, was he Tubeway Army? It was Tubeway Army, I guess it would have been billed as. And it was, and to this day, if you go and see Gary Numan, if you know,
he's playing in LA.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and he's a rocker. He's a punk, really. He was a punk and has gone back to his roots over the last probably 15 years. And when you go and see Gary Numan, it isn't a synth pop gig at all. But he came out on stage because I hadn't seen Bowie by the in 79. I hadn't seen Bowie and would have, you know, that would have been probably the thing for me. But he came out on stage at the Hammersmith Odeon and he just, it was in, he was androgynous and he had this pale face and he had the this black jumpsuit and this blue, and he had black, everything was black except for this blue and red tie. And I have one of those ties because I went to Kensington Market and bought one with my mates around the same time. He, where'd you get that tie from? We went and bought one. And he just came on and just had this brilliant light show as well. And at that point, I think, you're gone forever about Gary Numan. At that point, lots of gigs, you know, it was long hair and guitars and we're late 70s, we're post-punk. So New Wave was coming through, but he just made the effort to make it visually brilliant because lots of the guys were stood behind synthesizers. Mm-hmm. Billy Curry was on his violin, but really it was, apart from Sed Sharpley playing the drums, it was just guys behind synths, which as we all know can be very, very dull. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you go to a David Guetta gig, bless him, he's brilliant David Guetta, but it's just a guy behind two decks. And one of the dullest gigs I ever went to is Kraftwerk. I love Kraftwerk. I absolutely adore them. But it was the Pocket Calculator. It was the, you know, the Computer World tour, and they came out and it was really boring. And I guess at that time we were young and we were like, "Come on, do something."
You're expecting them to move.
Yeah, yeah. But now that's a legendary gig, and somebody said to me, "You went to that concert?" You know. So Gary Numan, I think Gary Numan / Tubeway Army, it was just brilliant, and it was. I came out of that concert thinking, I just want to be that guy. I just want to be in that world. And all that sound, the sound of those soaring synthesizers through a big PA. When you go and see his gigs now, he still does a few tracks. Mm-hmm. I'm getting the shivers now. There's these sounds of those synths where you go, oh, man, that, because that was totally me. I was totally against guitars at that point in my life. I was like, no, it's got to be electronic. So, yeah, Gary Numan.
It's so funny you say that because we've talked about this. Synth, I also love this kind of music. I don't have the knowledge you do. I'm just as a listener. But when synth was inserted in the, I guess in the 80s, into rock music here with some of the rock bands, did not like it at all. I do not feel rock. They don't go together to me. I don't.
Not what, that sort of Van Halen jump type synth moment.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Rush too. Rush. And,
right. Okay. Yeah.
That, I was, tried that I for was, a little while.
I was not a prog rock fan at all. And that kind of guys showing off. Yeah. I'm not really into that. Into dudes with, like, I've got so much money, I can buy all these keyboards. And then also I know how to do all this. That's not my thing. I'm much more simple and, you know.
But they were trying to evolve. I mean, I know a lot of them did use the synth. I mean, that was part of their sound. But Rush in particular, they inserted it, I think, because they were passionate. They wanted to evolve, but it's not. I don't like it. I don't like the, for as much as I love the synth pop music, I do not like it with my rock music.
Yeah. So then if you were talking post-punk, you know, when you had the new wave time, that was great. New Order, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That was guitarists. Not great guitarists, though. Not great musicians. Right. It was Manchester bands or whatever it might have been. That, I loved all that as well.
And you still love these bands. I mean, will you go see Depeche Mode if they play?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the last time I saw Depeche Mode, I'm very fortunate because I managed to meet a lot of these people. I managed to meet a lot of these people over in my career in radio generally. Mm-hmm. So I had some. Okay. So I have this kind of weird thing where, like, the last time I saw Depeche Mode was at, I think it was like Wembley. It was one of the big arenas in London. And went with three friends. And we just did that thing of, like, stumbling down the back steps and standing in amongst all the people and standing with a beer, not really being able to see very well. Martin Gore was behind a, you know, the front of house guy. And I was like, this is cool. I don't mind, you know, and just let the music wash over you. And I'm kind of too old now, guys. I'm 53. I'm not pushing down the front and standing in amongst all the people like that. And I did do that once. I once left when I was working for this company. I said, look, I've got to go back to London. It was outside London. So I've got to go back to London because I've got to do this thing. And I made up some excuse. And I went, I left this film shoot. I was the sound engineer on this film shoot. And I literally put the mic down on the floor. I have to go now. Sorry. And I left and came back to London and went to Wembley. So this was about 88, 89. And my mate Chris was waiting for me. And we got into Wembley to see Depeche Mode. I didn't tell them that. And we pushed all the way down to the front because we were going to stand right at the front and look right up Dave Garn's nose. And, in, you know, and we did that and it was great. But I was, you know, I was much younger. So, yeah, Depeche Mode was like a year or two ago, something like that.
Oh, I saw them at the Hollywood Bowl a year or so ago. And I asked Dan, I actually asked Dan because he's the biggest Depeche Mode fan I know. So I actually asked him to be my date, but it would have been a long haul for him.
A long way to go.
It was a great show. It was a great show.
I actually just,
where was that? Sorry, where was that? That was
Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
Last year, I think. Last year.
They have a film coming out this month.
They have an Anton Corbin film coming out, don't they?
I was just reading about today, actually.
I don't really know much about that movie, but it's what is it? Do you know much about the Depeche Mode film?
It's going to be visually beautiful.
It will be.
I'm sure it will be. But yeah, I'm sure a little concert film, a little bit. I'm sure behind the scenes type. Your concert, your basic Depeche Mode concert. Yeah.
Don't you have another Depeche Mode story to tell?
So okay, you said you got to meet people.
Yes.
Let's get into that. Did you meet Dave? Have you met Martin?
I've met Dave. Anybody that knows Depeche Mode knows that Dave Garn was clinically dead twice in his life. And so when you go to a Depeche Mode gig now, if you can get to go backstage and try and meet them, he doesn't hang around. He's over that and he just goes back to his hotel. Mm-hmm. They're all fairly kind of quiet about everything now. Fletch is very good friends with a friend of mine. And so I phone my friend up and I say, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? He's like, I'm in Fletch's back garden in Spain. We're just like, you know, hanging out in the sun. And I'm like, it's with Fletch from the Fletch Mode. That's so exciting. I've met Fletch and so I've kind of been introduced to them and shook their hands and stuff. So that's all good. And, you know, I'm still starstruck by people to this day. Even if I've probably met them a few times, are still, you know, certain bands, you're just like, it's them. They did. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about, because we all know this, if you're a music fan, when you meet somebody that's done something that absolutely touches your soul, I personally can't go, yeah, whatever, it's cool. You know, you just want to go, oh my God. I was at one of the ASCAP awards ceremonies and Annie Lennox went up to get an award and she sat back down and I had a few drinks and I thought, I'm just going to go up and say something because, you know, I don't want to miss this opportunity. So as I'd gone up to get my award, so I kind of thought, okay, I'm not just anybody now. I'm an award winner. She's not going to push me away. Her people aren't going to rugby tackle me to the ground as I move towards her, you know. And so I just went up to her and I just said, thank you for everything you've done. And she went, oh my God, that's so sweet. Thank you. And I shook her hand and I walked off and I'm like, Annie Lennox. You know, because she's obviously, again, the Eurythmics, phenomenal band.
See, that's the opposite of me. I could never do that because I think nothing good could come of that. Like, what are they going to say? Oh my, yeah. I mean, that's wonderful. That's genuine. Because I always feel like I'm going to say, just insert foot in mouth.
You're my biggest fan.
Like, what? What can I say that they have never heard before? And
I had a reason. I'd just gone on stage.
I was on the ward.
I'm with you. I wouldn't just walk straight up to them out of nowhere and go, hello, because it would be a little bit cheesy. But I thought, okay, I can sort of get away with this.
Did you have a ward in hand when you
talked
to
I had a ward in hand.
All right, very good.
But do you know what, like, though?
That's smart.
I will still go up to people and go, I'm so sorry. Can I just shake your hand? I don't say that because the one thing famous people hate is when you say, I'm really sorry. I know you don't like this, but... You know, any famous person I know has always said to me, I just wish people come and go, hey, can I get a photo? And they either go no or yes, you know. Anyway, so that was the Annie Lennox thing.
Well, that's good. Because it's either, they'll be a jerk or they'll be, or you'll feel like a jerk. I always feel like it's a no-win situation.
Well, I don't know. And you might go to your grave and go, I should have said something.
Well, I did wait, for Springsteen. I mean, Springsteen is my Gary Numan. I waited. He had a book signing. I waited like...
Days.
It was Rosh Hashanah. I waited I was not in temple. I was at the Temple of Bruce. And it was like 5-6 hours.
Yeah.
I just got to touch his soft leather jacket and I smiled and, you know, so...
And did you not... You didn't say anything to him?
I did say... I actually asked if he would do this for Elvis. And he said, I think I would. Like, yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah, it was right.
And a good question.
But I had 6 hours to think of that. When it's, I've been in situations where, you know, you see someone within, you know, right up to you and, or, you know, like, I can't. Yeah. I saw Michael Stipe. Like, no. Right. Nope.
Dave's a huge REM fan.
Okay. Well, so my David Bowie story. So I'll tell you my David Bowie story about that exact same. Well, nearly that exact same thing. When I was working on Virgin Radio, which is a commercial radio.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big brand, but it's a commercial radio station in the UK. And at the time, it was like 99, I think. So Bowie had an album out called Hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of getting some airplay, I think. Mm-hmm. We were playing it because Virgin's a rock station, and it was, you know, the Bowie fits the remit. Anyway, I went back to my desk because I was working on the breakfast show at the time, and the program director phoned me up and he said, "Hey, you know, I'm going over to the Maida Vale Studios, the BBC Maida Vale Studios, because Bowie's recording two songs for the station because Bowie was doing this junket, you know, and if you were playing his stuff, his new album, he would do a couple of songs for every single station." And he said, "Do you want to come down?" I was like, "Do I want to come down?"
I have chills.
Well, see.
Oh, my God.
"Do I want to come down?" So I was like that. Yeah, whatever, man, you know. So I jumped on my motorbike and I went over to Maida Vale. And we go into the studio and it's one of the small studios. It has this kind of mezzanine floor. So you've got these steps and you sit up on this. You're raised up over the top of whoever's, you know, recording and performing. And so we're ushered in. Me and this guy, Nick, who's a really good friend of mine. We're ushered into this room and I'm like, God, this is like the freakiest thing for me in the world, because from the age of 7 to now I'm in my 30s or whatever, you know, something like that. There he is. He had the long hair. He's smoking like a trooper. It's David Bowie. It's Gaylan Dorsey on bass and all the other guys on that band that he had at the time. And so we sit down and he plays one of the tracks off the new album, which I can't remember what it was. Sorry, David. And then he turns to us. So there's just me and Nick in this room with the plugger and a couple of other guys from the record label. And he looks up and he says, "What do you want us to do now then?" So, changes? I don't know. Pretty Things? I'm just throwing out the greatest songs ever. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Okay, here we go. You know, still don't know what I've been waiting for." And I'm sat there watching David Bowie singing a song that I tore the grooves out with the needle when I was a kid, in front of me for the two of us, you know. And he does it and he finishes this song and it's just the most fantastic thing. And so the guy, so they finish, you know, and he stops and he's smoking and everyone's shuffling about, and Mick from the record label comes up to me and he says, "Do you want to come and say hello?"
Yeah. Well, see, in that situation, fuck yeah.
No, I go like this. I go, really? So I go, "No, I don't know what to say to him. I absolutely can't do this because I'm going to be told."
Right, that's so funny.
Bless him. He says to me, "Shut up and come and say hello to him." You know, so I go down the stairs and I shake his hand and I said something about, I was something to do with, I come all this way and I get a terrible seat behind a pillar, because there was a pillar up there that we were kind of behind and we were ducking our heads around it, you know. I made some joke and he laughed and I was like, I've made him laugh. You know, I can go to my grave happy. And we chatted for what felt like probably 30 seconds. It might have been a bit longer. I don't know. And we got ushered out and I got back on my motorbike and I rode home at about 150 miles an hour. Thinking, if I die now, it doesn't matter because I've met him. I've met the guy. Yeah, yeah. I've met the man. Mm. And one-on-one, you know. And the next day, so anyway, I'll get on with this. So the next day I'm at my desk and the phone goes and it's the guy from the record label. He says, "Hey, you know, how did you think? Did you have a good time?" And I said, "Mick, you know, you don't understand, man. I bought Starman when I was 7. He said, "I didn't realize you were such a big fan." I said, yeah. You know, that was like a dream come true for me. He said, "Oh, because you should have hung around, because we went back to his hotel room. We hung out all night. He loves all that." I'm like, no. Anyway, so I kind of touched base with him and, you know, I will know to this day that I spoke to him.
Okay, so we'll stop it right here. Having so much fun. We will return next week. We will continue our discussion. And until then, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.